gentleman running a small operation, probably from home. He's doing a very good job of it, selling like those replacement rubber belts that go bad, dry out, and go bad on the tuning and loading control. He's got a lot of parts. Also, you cannot use, a lot of people make the mistake, they think they can use 6146 B's and boy tubes in that radio. And if you modify the, the neutralization circuit, you really need the 6146 A's. They're available from a company. The company has got thousands of tubes at a good price. They're all brand new, old stock. Antique Electronic Supply in Tempe, Arizona. They've got the best prices and best stock that I know of. Also, it depends how far you want to go with these kits, but there are websites on the internet where you can buy the original cabinet paint and respray them. And not recommending Craig do this at this time, but what I did on a Heath kit, an SB110, which is a 6-meter Heath kit, looks like it's 301-401. But I took the tubes out, the crystals out, anything that could be damaged, and I stuck it upside down in the dishwasher. We discussed the stick. Comes out clean as a whistle. Let everything dry out for about a month, and then fire it back up, back to net, and to you.
As you can tell, Greg, there are people who just love the older radios, particularly when it comes to Collins or Heathkit. There are groups of people out there that just worship Collins equipment. There are people out there that worship Heathkit equipment. So you find the right website, the right group of guys, the right antique sub-assembly suppliers, and you can have a grand old time with things like that. So you acquired these at a real good price at this local flea market, and it sounds like you got a couple of gems there. There are people who will love to buy them from you when you put them in good working order. There are people who will buy them from you not in good working order when they're properly advertised. KD2CXK, K2RIW. Go ahead, Craig.
Okay, thanks a lot, Dick. And of course, I want to thank Rich and thank Hal for their input as well. It came pretty much ready to go. I have all the original manuals and so forth, quite a few manuals. They came with the original power cords, but they did not come with the interconnect cables, which from just a glance, looking at them, just seemed to be straight RCA to RCA male-to-male patch cords, unless, of course, somebody on the next go-around tells me different. They're completely intact, and I was told they're working fine. The microphone is a static tall chrome stand desk microphone, real nice, beautiful condition. And I'm not ashamed to say that I paid $100 for everything. So who cares if it works or doesn't? I'm sure I'll always get that money back. Anything else I need to know? KD26, hey, back to net.
Dick, I feel like murdering this guy. And here we go.
You got any further words for him other than the fact that he got a good deal? Any other hints on those SB301 and 401, Rich?
I'd have to look at them, but it sounds like he got a wonderful deal, to say the least. They can be... The nice thing about this older equipment, it can be put back into like new condition. It depends how much work he wants to put into it. I can tell you one thing that comes to mind on the 301 receiver and some of the other stuff. If you get an oscillation in the audio stage or some kind of strange oscillation in the transmitter, tighten down the screws that hold the PC board to the chassis. There's a whole number of PC boards, and what happens is, over time, the screws loosen up, and the ground to the chassis doesn't make 100%. So that's one thing you may want to do. Back to the
level of metal there, copper on the PC board, and aluminum on the chassis. And so my guess is the right way to do it, if it was a Cadillac, would be to have the printed circuit board gold-plated on top of the copper. Well, actually, it takes a flashing of nickel in between. So copper, nickel flashing, gold, and then the gold comes in contact with aluminum chassis, and you no longer have dissimilar metals. But copper coming in contact with aluminum or steel, doesn't matter, eventually it's going to build up an oxide and a poor contact. So therefore, grinding down on those screws, or maybe even picking up the PC board and cleaning it with something like Scotch-Brite, or maybe even putting a layer of solder. I do remember when I had to have copper straps on the aluminum rods of my 6-meter Yagi homebrew antenna. They would build up some huge dissimilar metal grunge white stuff between the copper and the aluminum. And copper and aluminum are dissimilar metals that are not supposed to be brought into contact with each other, particularly now in the weather. Let me drop this. However, copper and solder are compatible. Solder and aluminum are compatible. So all I had to do is to tin the copper straps with solder, then reattach them to the aluminum elements of the 6-meter Yagi. I think they were 1-inch diameter or 3/4-inch diameter. EMT tubing was the actual element. After that, I had no further trouble with intermittent contacts. So there's probably a refurbishing concept that can be added to a PC board if there are dissimilar metals to make that kind of improvement. And he might not have said that in the manual. Anybody got any further words on the intermittent? By the way, I've seen a number of circuits where the PC board stopping a good grounding becomes unstable. I've also seen lots of circuits where an edge-mounted printed circuit board that goes into a motherboard, which has a less than ideal edge connector socket, where it starts developing intermittent contacts. And by unseating the PC board and reseating it back into the socket and rocking it, or putting the right kind of tuner cleaner in there, can drastically improve things. Anybody have any further comment on the grounding of the PC boards on the Heathkit rigs? Give me your call letters, K2RIW, the TechNet. Okay, as you make improvements on those beauties you got there, Craig, come back and let us know how well they work and how pretty they become after you clean them all up. We've come to the end of the question and answer period, and now John's going to go to the mailbag, and whether or not you use Kay's question first or cover another one first, and then we'll go over to Kay, is your choice, John. Because when we do go over to Kay's question on the subject of interferometry antennas, it's going to be a relatively long discussion on that subject. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. No, I set aside all the other questions. There'll be none from the mailbag this week. Just this one question, which is going to be extensive on the answer. And we'll probably need the basic discussion this week, which will take the full time, because she's looking for a lot of answers. And we'll probably get some questions and carry on a little bit, probably next week also. And it's good that this is going to be recorded, so she'll be able to tune in and listen to it. And her question is on interferometry, and she would like to know, as I said, the difference between the optical and the RF, what it's used for, how it's used, what do they glean from it, the full concept. So maybe you start out basic tonight, cover all of the basics, and then maybe we can carry on a little bit next week. Great subject, though. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, this rather innocent question that Kay asked. And by the way, tell me, John, what are Kay's call letters?
I don't remember the calls. I didn't write them down. I know I have them on file somewhere. But she did not write through the email. She called me on the phone. Pleasure to talk to this young lady. Very bright, very quick. So, good stuff.
Yeah, somebody just signed in who probably knows Kay. Can you tell me Kay's call letters?
It's Craig. It's Alpha Charlie 2 Lima Romeo.
Okay, I heard the number 2, Charlie Romeo. What was the prefix?
Alpha Charlie 2 Lima Romeo.
Okay, Alpha Charlie 2 Lima Romeo.
Okay.
A LIMOG member who was at the same board meeting that I was at way back in June or July. Let me drop. Now, Kay is asking what is interferometry, is my understanding. What's the difference between RF interferometry and optical interferometry? And because radio, electromagnetic wave, make it low enough in frequency and then couple it with wire, and you and I call it 60 cycle power from Con Ed or from LIPA, go high enough in frequency, and we call it something you convey with a coax cable or a twin lead, you go to an antenna with it, go high enough in frequency, you start using waveguide, go high enough in frequency of the exact same electromagnetic wave, just go high enough in frequency, and we call it far infrared, near infrared, optical, near ultraviolet, far ultraviolet, near x-ray, hard x-ray, and so on. Eventually, gamma ray, I guess you could call it. In other words, it's the exact same spectrum. And just to give you a gut feel for what is optical frequencies, we all have, as VHF, UHF operators on 450 and 2 meters, we have a little bit of a feeling for what is 600 megahertz. If somebody showed us a Yagi for 600 megahertz, it wouldn't look it wouldn't look too strange to us. It'd just be a little bit smaller than the 450 megacycle Yagi. Let me drop. But you take that frequency, 600 megahertz, and multiply it 1 million times higher in frequency, and that's what you and I call optical. 550 nanometers of wavelength. By the way, what happened, why in the world do we call it 10 meters, 20 meters, 40 meters, 80 meters? Because in the early days, you didn't have a frequency counter. You had a tool called electrowires, which allowed you to measure wavelength. Well, the same thing is going on with optical. The middle of the optical band, we call it 550 nanometers of wavelength, because we don't have a frequency counter up there yet, per se. So that's part of how the tradition of our 40-meter band at around 7 megacycles came about. In the early days, you couldn't measure 7 megacycles on a frequency counter. Well, you could get a crystal and beat it against and make some judgment as to what the frequency was. But you weren't measuring it directly. You were measuring it indirectly. But in the case of wavelength, you're making a direct measurement. So it's all the exact same spectrum. So what I'm about to tell you about radio interferometry is also true of optical interferometry. And the subject of interferometry is very poorly covered in schools. Very poor. The only people who have made a lot of use of interferometry are the radio astronomers, because in the case of an optical telescope where the frequency is 1 million times higher than usual radio frequencies, you get a hell of a lot more optical gain and narrow beamwidth out of a optical telescope. And the radio people, because they're using wavelengths that are a million times bigger, they would like to have the so-called antenna, call it the parabolic reflector, they'd like it to be a million times larger. Well, you probably don't have enough real estate to do that in a lot of cases. Let me drop it. In the old days, the biggest radio telescope was Arecibo's 1,000-foot diameter. I think it still is the biggest single partially steerable. You steer the feed on that one. You don't steer the dish. And the 100 meter, the 100 meter very large telescope at Green Bank, West Virginia, and I watched that thing under construction. That's the biggest fully steerable parabolic dish. I think it's like 1.5 acres of reflector. And that thing is supposed to operate from roughly 1 gigahertz all the way up to something like 110 gigahertz because of the way it corrects all of its individual mirrors that make up that great big composite mirror. And believe it or not, that is operating by interferometry. You're about to find out what I mean by that. Now, because you can't easily build a radio telescope that's the same number of wavelengths in diameter as an optical telescope, because that million to one wavelength characteristic or million to one frequency range characteristic, what you do is you build the biggest radio telescope you can. You set one up in, say, Socorro, New Mexico,
set up another one in Honeysuckle Creek, Australia. Make sure that the two of them are well coordinated. They're both aimed at the exact same star at the exact same instant in time, and make very accurate recordings in Australia and in New Mexico. Let me drop. You take those two recordings, you bring them together at a good site that can process the data, that can combine the data and process it, and you get some of the characteristics of a telescope that's that large. I'm going to make a guess that the real straight line distance between Honeysuckle Creek, Australia, and the place in New Mexico, Arizona, New Mexico, I'm assuming it's roughly 6,000 miles apart, and then as such, you'll get some of the optical resolution, let's call it radio resolution, as if you had a radio telescope 6,000 miles in diameter. You don't get all of the light gathering power, but you get some of the characteristics. Let's find out what is a interferometer and why is it so extremely valuable. Now, I could give you a bunch of formulas. That wouldn't do it any good. I'm going to give you a couple of rules of thumb. I'm going to give you a real working example. Let me drop. Because one of my favorite bands is 10 gigahertz, I have in my hand a Nauta standard gain horn made for 8.4 to 12.4 gigahertz, the 10 gigahertz handband, so to speak. The standard gain horn is called Model 640 by Nauta, one of their standard products. It is a standard gain horn with something like 15.5 dB of gain, and the mouth of that horn is just about exactly 3 inches wide. Okay, one of the rules of thumb that many a good antenna engineer will use is that you tell me how many wavelengths wide is the mouth of your antenna, the emitting surface of the antenna. Take that number of wavelengths, divide it into 70 degrees, the result is the beam width of the antenna. So because 10 gigahertz is very close to 1 inch, and because the mouth of this feed horn is 3 inches wide, I divide 3 into 70 degrees, and I come out with 23 and a third degrees. In other words, this feed horn on 10 gigahertz has a beam width of 23.5 degrees, 23 and a third degrees, by that calculation. It's a rough rule of thumb. It probably has 5% error to it, but good enough. Puts you into the ballpark. So, if I was using this horn, let me drop. If I was using this horn to do direction finding, to try to find the source of a signal, where the horn is 23.5 degrees, half power beam width, plus or minus a 11.6 degrees. 23 degrees wide is our total beam width. You could say that for me to find the direction of arrival to the nearest 23 degrees is pretty easy, and maybe I could half that, get down to the nearest to 12 or so degrees. If I want greater accuracy than that, I've got to do something. I either got to make or buy or build a bigger horn, or the quick and dirty way to do it, the way that gives you a hell of a lot of performance with very little effort, is interferometry. If I had a pair of these horns, and I do own a pair, I could mount the two horns side by side. Now the equivalent, and use a power divider to feed the two. And so that would now be one composite antenna side by side. And so it would have 6 inches of width across the front instead of 3 inches. Instead of 23 degrees of beam width, it would have 11 degrees of beam width. But there's a much better way. Once I've got these two horns, I don't have to put them side by side. I can put them on a horizontal stick that is 12 inches long. I can separate the two horns by 12 inches. But now let me show you the great advantage of doing that. Drop. Assume that I know that the source of the signal I'm trying to direction find on is coming from approximately north. And now I've got this horizontal bar that's going from east to west, parallel to the ground. The bar is 12 inches long. On the right-hand side of the bar, I attach one of these horns, the 3-inch wide X-band horn, and on the left-hand side of the rod, I put one of these horns. So these two horns, each got a 3-inch wide mouth to them, but they're both mounted on the same horizontal bar, east-west, of each other. They both aim exactly north, and they're 12 inches apart. I've now got a real interferometer. I've got a power divider from the, if I'm transmitting, I've got the signal coming out of the transmitter going into a 2-to-1 power divider, equal length of cable going to the two separate horns.
or conversely, that's the way I'm setting it up for a receiver. I receive the signals coming back through that power divider fed backwards. It's now a power summer, and it goes into the receiver. So the horizontal bar is east-west. The two horns on the ends are both aimed dead north. Now I start rotating that horizontal bar about its center. I've got a vertical mast going into some kind of an antenna rotator, and I start rotating that bar. In other words, if I looked at the whole system top view, the bar, you could say, goes from 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock. The two horns are both aimed toward 12 o'clock, they're both aimed dead north, and I'm about to start rotating the bar so that the right-hand side of the bar that used to be at 3 o'clock is about to start going toward 3:30. And the left-hand side of the bar that used to be at 9 o'clock is starting to go toward 9:30. Okay. The magic of what's about to happen is that as I rotate the bar by 2.4 degrees, I wouldn't even be getting near 3:30, if you know what I mean. I've only rotated a couple of minutes on the clock. I've rotated the bar 2.4 degrees by a simple law of trigonometry.
Repeater, timeout.
Okay. Looks like I've timed out the eastern repeater. Let's see if I can get that to come back. The eastern repeater has come back. Hopefully we're all back in shape. The magic of trigonometry in this case is that if I've got a hypotenuse that is 12 inches long, and I open up the angle between the hypotenuse and the long leg of this triangle by 2.4 degrees, the left-hand side of the triangle has moved half an inch. What does that mean? My left-hand feed horn has moved forward by a quarter of an inch. The right-hand feed horn has moved back by a quarter of an inch. The distance between the two toward north has moved by half an inch. That's a fancy way of saying one half wavelength of difference between the two horns that are both aimed toward north, so to speak. I moved them half a wavelength. Half a wavelength really means that the right-hand horn is now transmitting a signal that gets to the northern site 90 degrees sooner, 90 degrees of phase angle sooner. The right-hand horn has been moved backwards. It's now transmitting a signal that arrives 90 degrees late. Those two signals get combined at the receiving site way up north, and those two signals are 180 degrees out of phase. They cancel. Let me drop it. In other words, the first null in the composite antenna pattern is 2.4 degrees of rotation of this fancy interferometer. The individual horns are 23 degrees wide. But this interferometer, I only have to move it 2.4 degrees, and I go into the first null in the antenna pattern. Turns out that if I had moved it not 2.4 degrees, but half of that, 1.2 degrees, the antenna pattern, the two signals arriving up north would be plus 45 degrees and minus 45 degrees, and that's the point where you get half power, 3 dB down. The 3 dB beamwidth is plus or minus 1.2 degrees of this interferometer. Do you see how sharp that antenna pattern is when you put two antennas side by side? A 23 degree beamwidth antenna becomes plus or minus 1.2, becomes 2.4 degrees wide. I get a 10 to 1 improvement in directivity of the antenna by putting these two antennas side by side. And the reason why it has that antenna pattern is interferometry. One antenna, when I rotate the whole system, one antenna is moving forward, one antenna is moving back. The phase angle between the two starts increasing. Pretty soon you get a null, or you get a 3 dB down, 6 dB down, and so on. You start getting a very sharp antenna pattern when you set up interferometry. Let me drop it. That radio telescope that uses Socorro, New Mexico, and Honeysuckle Creek, Australia, 6,000 miles apart, they get a very sharp antenna pattern because those two telescopes are on this rotating Earth, and as the Earth rotates once every 24 hours, one antenna, so to speak, is moving closer to that star, one antenna is moving further from the star, and you start getting these peaks and valleys in space. Starting to see the power of interferometry. And now this has got two other subsets of capability that you wouldn't believe. Let me drop this. When I took my original interferometer of these two horns 12 inches apart, and I rotated that whole horizontal bar by 2.4 degrees, and I found the first null. in the antenna pattern, because the two signals coming out of those two horns arrive at the site up north, which I'm aiming towards, so to speak. They arrive 180 degrees out of phase, and there's a null in the pattern. If I now had a way of phase shifting, if I plugged in an extra half wavelength of cable on the left-hand antenna, the one that got moved closer to the northern site, the left-hand antenna, because I'm rotating the whole thing clockwise, if I added an extra half wavelength of cable, those two signals that used to be out of phase are now in phase. I now electronically steered the antenna by adding an extra half wavelength of cable. The whole antenna has been rotated 2.4 degrees clockwise. I used to have a null. I suddenly plug in an extra half wavelength of cable on the left-hand side. That null just turned into a peak. And by the way, if I now rotate back towards 0 degrees of rotation, now I'm going to have another null. You now see the principle of operation of an electronically steerable phased array. So not only does this interferometer give me an extremely sharp antenna pattern with much higher directivity, much sharper capability of determining the angle of arrival of a signal. Let me drop. But once I realize the way the thing works, I can now build electronic circuits that slowly phase shift or rapidly phase shift the signal of one antenna versus the other, and I can electronically steer that beam in space. The advantage of electronic steering is I can change that phase shift by electronic means. The sloppy way of doing it is by adding a half wavelength of cable in my example. But by electronic circuits, I can shift that 180 degrees in probably a microsecond, and maybe even a fraction of a microsecond if I use the right kind of circuit. I can steer that beam in space in periods of time of a microsecond. You try to mechanically operate something, rotate something that fast, you don't stand a chance. It'll break and fly apart long before you get anywhere near that kind of speed. But electronically, you can see what I can do. Now, you've now seen by the process of interferometry where an antenna pattern is coming from. Let me drop. The next step in this understanding is that the highest gain antenna you and I use on a daily basis is your flashlight. Your flashlight has a light bulb in the old-fashioned incandescent-type flashlight. It's got a light bulb which is very close to an isotropic radiator. It radiates a signal in all directions in space simultaneously. But behind the light bulb, inside of your flashlight, you've got this parabolic silver reflector. Your headlight on your automobile does the same sort of thing. So the back hemisphere of all that signal coming out of that light bulb hits the parabolic reflector, and the magic of a parabolic reflector, when the light bulb is at the focal point, is that every single path coming out of the back of that flashlight bulb that hits the parabolic reflector, because of angle of incidence equals angle of reflection, you got this very fancy curve called a parabolic curve. This is a parabola of revolution. It's a three-dimensional parabola. That's what your flashlight reflector is. Every one of those beams reflecting off that reflector comes back out, going straight forward, all in exact parallel with each other. Let me drop. So you've got millions of light rays coming off your bulb in the back hemisphere, all hitting that parabolic reflector. And after reflecting off that parabolic reflector, every one of those light waves is exactly parallel with each other, and they're all equal in phase. The path length from the light bulb to the parabolic reflector and out forward, every one of those paths has the exact same length. That phase front being emitted by your flashlight is a perfect planar wave. It's got a all-in-phase, planar wave phase front of that signal coming out of your flashlight. Now think about that. All of the individual rays coming off your light bulb, hitting that reflector, are all exactly parallel and giving you a perfectly planar in-phase phase front. What could be any better than that? Let me drop. As such, assume the reflector on your light bulb is 3 inches in diameter. There is, in theory, a perfectly collimated wave, 3 inches in diameter, coming out of your flashlight. We'd like to believe that after that flashlight beam goes 100 yards and hits the garage door, so to speak, the 3-inch diameter beam coming out of the flashlight would light up a spot on the garage door that's 3 inches in diameter. All those waves are perfectly parallel. It's a perfectly planar wavefront. Nothing is imperfect in it. So therefore, a 3-inch diameter wave coming out of the flashlight for a 3-inch diameter light beam, you'd like to say 100 yards downrange, it's going to be 3 inches diameter. You do that experiment, and you find out the light beam at the, on the garage door is a foot in diameter. It's spread out. Why does it do that? Let me show you why. Let me drop it. It turns out that that parabolic reflector is a whole lot of individual interferometers. In the case of the 2 feet ones that I had side by side, 12 inches apart in my example, when I rotated them at that frequency with that spacing, it gave me a first null at 2.4 degrees of rotation. 3 dB down, it was 1.2 degrees of rotation, plus or minus 1.2 degrees. So I had a 2.4 degree beam width. Because of the spacing of the horns and the way the signals add up in phase and out of phase. Let me drop. A parabolic reflector really is a whole bunch of interferometers. I could take a tiny little spot, a few millimeters in diameter, on the far right-hand side of the parabolic reflector, take a corresponding spot on the far left-hand side of the parabolic reflector. Those two points are an interferometer. I now can take the next two spots a little bit closer together, a little bit closer to the center on the right-hand side and then the left-hand side, and that's a pair of interferometers. By the same token, my original interferometer on the 12-inch long rod, and I had 2 feed horns, I could start filling in other feed horns in between. Make it a total of 6 feed horns and make it a 6-to-1 power divider, and I've now gone from a 2-element interferometer to a 6-element interferometer. What happens when you do that? In the case of the 6 feed horns, where I start filling in the area in between, now when I rotate the exact same 1.2 degrees to the right or to the left, the two outer horns, the signal coming out of them, does cancel. But the next two horns closer together, closer to the center of rotation, they didn't move quite as far. Those two signals are not out of phase. Therefore, the whole composite antenna of 6 horns, that's not where the first null takes place. I have to now rotate a little bit further to get to the first null. As I start filling in the space with more and more elements of this interferometer, the beam width becomes a little bit broader. If I was doing it as a receiving device, I've now got more receiving area, I'm going to get more signal, and the pattern is going to get a little bit cleaner looking. In the case of that 2-element interferometer, the first null was plus or minus 1.2 degrees, the second peak was plus or minus 4.7 degrees. Wait a minute, first null was 2.4 degrees plus or minus, the next peak is plus or minus 4.7 degrees. The problem is the next peak at 4.8 degrees, clockwise or counterclockwise rotation, is that that next peak is a little bit weaker than the main lobe, the beginning was, the one when I started, before I started doing any rotation. Let me drop. And if the individual horns happen to be isotropic antennas, antennas with no directivity themselves, the individual elements as they're called, then that next peak at plus or minus 4.8 degrees would have the exact same amplitude as the main lobe with 0 degrees of rotation. Because the horns themselves have a 23 degree beam width, and I've now rotated the whole thing 4.8 degrees, so I'm 4.8 degrees away from the bore site of each individual horn. There's some fairly simple mathematics called cosine theta squared, cosine squared theta. In other words, if I take the angle of rotation, multiply it by the right constant, take the cosine of that and square it, that tells me exactly what the antenna pattern is going to be. It's a very good rule of approximation that's used by antenna people, and until you get a rotation from the bore site of your antenna, until you go down about 10 or so dB, that formula fits very nicely. So, in other words, I can know how many dB down is my horn when I only rotate 4.8 degrees to the second peak. And you go through that formula and you find out the antenna pattern is 1 dB less gain when you're 4.8 degrees away from bore site of each individual horn. Let me drop. Therefore, this interferometry pattern that I'm telling you about, where you rotate 2.4 degrees, I get the first null. You rotate 4.8 degrees, I get the second peak. That second peak is 1 decibel weaker than the main lobe. It's a bit of an ambiguity problem, but with the right kind of computer processing, you can learn to live with that. And so as you start filling in the individual, by adding more horns in between those two outer horns, by adding more horns, I get a stronger signal, I get more gain, because I've got more emitting area, or when I'm receiving, I get a stronger signal, because I've got more receiving area. I start to, the first null now takes place at a greater angle, because I've now got more antennas that have to be combined in order to get that first null. The easiest way to now see mathematically what's happening with this is to draw a polar diagram. In the case of a polar diagram, let me drop. You draw a circle, and from the center of that circle, you draw a pair of arrows straight up toward 12 o'clock. That is the electronic equivalent of the signal that exists with an interferometer with two horns 12 inches apart, and I haven't rotated the whole antenna yet. That's my Borsite pattern. And the way a polar diagram is usually set up is the magnitude of those arrows represents the signal strength picked up or transmitted by that horn. The rotation of the arrow tells your phase shift. Okay? In that polar diagram, when I took that interferometer and I rotated 2.4 degrees and I'm at the first null, on the polar diagram, what happened? One of those arrows at 12 o'clock rotated itself toward 3 o'clock. That's the arrow that advanced in phase. That was the horn that went closer to north. The other arrow rotated counterclockwise toward 9 o'clock. That's the horn on the right-hand side that was delayed in phase because it got moved further away from the northern detecting site. So on the polar diagram, the way you explain the first null is those two arrows that used to be straight up, and they combined and gave you a double-sized arrow toward 12 o'clock. One of those arrows rotated toward 3 o'clock, one of those arrows clockwise, one of those arrows rotated counterclockwise toward 9 o'clock. 3 o'clock, 9 o'clock, equal amplitude arrow, you combine them, you get zero. That's the way vectors combine. That explains the first null in the antenna pattern. As a polar diagram, why does in phase and out of phase, two signals 180 degrees out of phase, why do they give you a null? As a polar diagram, it's a little bit easier to see. Let me drop. Now, when I went from the two-horn interferometer, 12 inches apart, and I added two more horns, and those two horns are, I'll pick a number, 8.5 inches apart or something like that. Because the two horns I've added, so I've now got a total of four, and I've got a 4-to-1 power divider, because the two horns I've added are closer to the center of rotation. When I rotate that horizontal bar, which by the way is called the moment arm, when I rotate the moment arm, the same 2.4 degrees, the two outer horns, the 2 hours at 12 o'clock, are still at 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock. The two inner horns didn't rotate as far. One of those is at 1:30, the other one's at 10:30. Now when I combine those four arrows, I don't have a node yet. You can see now why, when I add the extra horns, the null moves to another place. Now I have to rotate the whole moment arm a little bit further. I don't know the exact number, but instead of 2.4 degrees to get the first null, maybe I've got to rotate to 3 degrees to get the first null. When I do that, of the four arrows on that polar diagram, one of them is now at 4:30, one of them is at 1:30, one of them's at 7:30, and one of them's at 10:30. Those four arrows now combine to zero. You now see why, when you go to four-element interferometer, you get a slightly broader pattern with higher gain. Higher gain as far as signal strength is concerned. A little bit less apparent directivity. But now when that four horn is rotated, that first null, which is a larger number of degrees away, each individual horn, you're a little bit further away from the Borsite of the horns. Therefore, that first, second peak, instead of being 1 dB down, is probably going to be 2 dB down, if you know what I mean. You now see the advantage of filling in the extra area if you have the resources to do it.
A repeater, timeout.
Okay, we still got the Eastern repeater. Glad to see it. So, every antenna you have ever used can be considered as an interferometer with a whole lot of individual elements. Every parabolic reflector, every horn, you can break up the signal coming out of that large parabolic reflector. Here in your flashlight example, you can take little chunks of area, the far right-hand side, the far left-hand side, consider that two elements of an interferometer, then start adding other elements that are in closer and closer. The interferometry pattern is where the pattern of a antenna comes from. That's where the pattern of your antenna comes from. The directivity comes from that. Portions of your antenna, as you go off of boresight, when you rotate the antenna, portions of the antenna are in phase, portions are out of phase when it comes to the remote receiving site, and now you know where the 3 dB beam width comes from, where the null comes from, where the second side, where the first side lobe comes from, and the second side lobe. All these antenna patterns are really a large number of elements of interferometry.
Question.
That explains why your flashlight, starting off at a 3-inch beam width, emitted a parallel beam, thoroughly collimated beam, emitted by your flashlight, 3 inches diameter. When it goes 1,000 yards downrange, there's a foot diameter because it's got an antenna beam width, because the individual portions of that parabolic reflector are really a multi-element interferometer, a multi-element phased array. There's all kinds of ways you can explain it. When it comes to explaining where an antenna pattern comes from, the way we teach our students is they plug in numbers to a formula. It's never really explained to them as to where the finite beam width comes from. Where does the first null come from? Where does the first side lobe come from? It's all interferometry. Almost every antenna pattern you have ever seen is really an interferometer if you break it down into fine enough elements. Let me drop. So it's time we take a little break here. Wes, what's your question on this as to what we've covered so far? N2XJN, K2RIW.
You're probably going to laugh at this. You have one antenna. You don't have two antennas. One horn antenna. And now, you move that antenna as if the circle of the movement of the center of the horn were vertical. So the antenna is horizontal. Now, let's say 2.5 degrees or whatever the angle, that antenna is in movement. And the time is being recorded for every position of an antenna. Do you have interferometer from it? In other words, is you comparing the information of out of phase and in phase just based on the data collected from the antenna moving in the pattern of the circle that is a vertically placed, but an antenna is horizontally shooting? And to see it.
The way you've asked the question, Wes, there's two or three different questions you could be asking. I'm going to give you some further information that might make it more clear. The interferometer that I started off with has a moment arm that connects the two antennas that's 12 inches long. Top view, that horizontal bar, the moment arm that's supporting the two antennas, is parallel to the earth. In my top view, you could say the bar goes from 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock. Okay? And if I put a horn antenna on each end of that bar, and the horn is aimed north, and I'm about to do some receiving up north as to what's going on, I showed you sort of that by the law of trigonometry, it's a sine theta, so to speak, as I rotate that moment arm, clockwise top view, one horn is moved forward, one horn is moved back. Therefore, there's a phase shift of those two signals that are about to be combined at that remote receiving site north. Now, there's two other pieces of information I've got to give you here. Number one, mankind almost always thinks in watts and power. Mother Nature doesn't do that. Mother Nature almost always thinks in voltage. You take the voltage from the left-hand antenna that's received up north. You take the voltage from the right-hand antenna that's received up north. And that receiving antenna up north combines those two voltages by adding them in a vector manner. In other words, you add those two voltages together, including their phase angle. Okay? In order to figure out what's going on,
you can now break it down one step at a time. Leave the left-hand horn on that moment arm, that horizontal bar. Remove the right-hand horn, or turn off the signal to the right-hand horn. Feed a signal only to the left-hand horn. And now set up your vector voltmeter, your vector, why can't I think of the name of the thing? The machine that we're all talking about so often, Rodin Schwarz, it's not called vector voltmeter.
Vector
voltmeter. Yeah. One at a time. John, tell me the word of the thing I can't think of.
Network analyzer, DNA.
Vector network analyzer. I couldn't think of vector network analyzer. I've owned vector voltmeters. So my vector network analyzer is now set up so that the J1 port of the vector network analyzer is connected to that left-hand horn. The right-hand horn...
Vector signal analyzer. Vector network analyzer to something that is not in the form of electromagnetic wave. It's the signal. Enter here.
Now, this is an antenna range, and lots of smart people have used a vector network analyzer on a signal range, on an antenna range. I did it for 10 solid years, and that's where those patents came from. So a vector network analyzer does a beautiful job, if you know what you're doing, of plotting an antenna pattern. So I'm setting up my vector network analyzer. The J1 port of the vector network analyzer, the so-called transmitting port, is connected only to that left-hand horn. The right-hand horn, we're not doing anything with it. The J2 port of the vector network analyzer is connected to that receiving site up north with a nice long piece of cable, and I've calibrated the system. I now start rotating the moment arm, that bar, that bar that goes from 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock. I start rotating it clockwise from the top view. There's a vertical mast coming out of a rotating machine, like a ham rotator, and I do a little bit of rotating. And I rotate it 2.4 degrees, that bar. What will the vector network analyzer see? It'll see a one decibel decrease in antenna amplitude, because as I rotate that bar, the bore site of that horn moved by 2.4 degrees and is not aimed exactly at the antenna of north. That's one thing I'll see on the vector network analyzer. The vector network analyzer will also show me, hey, that signal just shifted by plus 90 degrees in phase angle. You say, wow, I see it. So one horn rotated 2.4 degrees. I watched that horn go plus 90 degrees in phase angle because it moved closer. I now disconnect the left-hand horn and connect the right-hand horn all by itself, and I repeat the experiment. Again, I will see the signal fall off by 1 dB when I rotate it 2.4 degrees, but now I see 90 degrees of lag in phase angle of the signal being received up north. It now becomes a little bit more clear why when I feed both horns simultaneously...
Repeater, timeout.
It now becomes a little bit more clear when I feed two horns simultaneously with a power divider, and as I rotate the horizontal moment arm, the moment arm as it's called, I rotate that bar clockwise top view by 2.4 degrees, the left-hand signal got advanced by 90 degrees, the right-hand signal got retarded by 90 degrees, those two signals are 180 degrees apart, those are two voltage vectors, essentially equal in magnitude, but 180 degrees out of phase with each other, and because Mother Nature thinks in voltage, and every receiving antenna takes all the voltages of all the multi-paths that exist. Whenever you transmit a signal, there's a zillion paths by which that signal goes from point A to point B. Even though one transmitting signal is on top of a mountain, the second receiving site is on top of a second mountain, and you think there's nothing but the direct path. In almost every real situation, that signal is bouncing off of every leaf, every tree, all the ground, and all the buildings and water towers and everything else. The signal is bouncing off of everything. That's multipath. You've got a zillion signals going to that receiving site. Each one of them is an individual voltage at an individual phase angle. Let me drop. And what that receiving antenna does is it takes every one of those voltages with their phase angles, really what you mean by a vector, and adds them all together. And that's the resultant signal you get. So whether it's an interferometer, whether it's a multipath situation, you're always adding individual voltages.
So now you can see on a two-element interferometer that as you start extending the length of that moment arm between the two horns, in my example, the number of degrees rotation of the whole network before you get the first null becomes smaller and smaller. I'm starting to get sharper and sharper angular resolution. That's the good news. The bad news is that if my individual elements, my individual horns, don't have a sharp enough pattern to begin with, you've now got a whole lot of first side lobe, second side lobe, third side lobe, and they might be very close to the same amplitude. Therefore, try to figure out which one is the Mohr site and which one is the first, second, and third side lobe becomes a little bit more difficult, but there's ways around that. Remember I told you that if you start shifting the phase of one horn versus the other horn and recognize the way the signal strength changes, whether you're transmitting or receiving, doesn't matter, I'm now starting to go into a phased array. As I start shifting the phase, I can now move those peaks and valleys around and recognize how fast they move versus how fast I'm moving the phase of my electronic steering network, and I'm now really using phased array antenna techniques in order to draw the pattern out there in space, so to speak, of what is that thing I'm looking at. I've now described it all to you in one dimension. This is only a horizontal interferometer. There's nothing stopping me from making a vertical interferometer and start combining those two, one step at a time or all combined. Depends on how much computer processing I've got. I can now make a lot of sense out of that. But the real bottom line of all this is that everybody knows every antenna has got a certain beam width to it, a certain 3dB beam width, 10dB beam width, first and null beam width, and so on, first side lobe level, a certain number of degrees apart. Let me drop. And no one has ever explained to them where does that pattern come from. It is interferometry. Every antenna pattern you have ever seen is really a multi-element interferometer. You have to take that great big parabolic reflector and break it up into a whole lot of little pieces to see what the interferometer is really doing. And believe it or not, many of the computer modeling programs for antennas do exactly that. It calculates how much current flows through each one of the elements, each little square inch or each square 16th of an inch of the antenna, how much current is flowing, how much magnetic field is that creating, how much magnetic field from that little element gets received at the receiving site, and it adds them all together in a vector manner. So all of the antenna patterns you've ever seen really are interferometers, and so most of the antenna books I know about do not explain it that way. They don't really tell you where the antenna pattern comes from. They just tell you this antenna has got that many degrees of beamwidth, and that antenna has that many degrees of beamwidth. Or in the case of a horn, the guys use a dish, the guys use this rule of thumb. If you're a optical astronomer and you use the classic way of doing it, you take the diameter of the telescope and you plug it into a formula, 1.22 times lambda over D. Lambda is the wavelength you're using, and D is the diameter of your telescope mirror, so to speak. And the 1.22 is a correction factor that makes the answer come out in radians. Well, you take 1.22 and you multiply it by what one radian is, 57.3 degrees, and you come up with 70 degrees. So the antenna people use a formula of 70 degrees times lambda over D. Or, that's if you want to do it on pencil and paper, 70 degrees times lambda over D. Lambda is the wavelength you're working with, D is the diameter of your antenna. Let me drop it. But when the guys do it by mental mathematics, they do it one step simpler. They've got a good gut feel for what wavelength is. They know that if they're at 900 megacycles, the wavelength is X number of inches, so to speak. Or if they're at 450 megacycles, they know the wavelength is very close to 70 centimeters. So knowing how many inches or centimeters is the antenna, the horizontal width of the horn or the horizontal width of the parabolic reflector, and they divide that by the wavelength that they know about, and if the answer comes up 10 wavelengths, and they know that their correction factor is 70 degrees, and they divide 10 into 70, and they come up with 7, they know that that antenna that is 10 wavelengths wide has a beam width that's very close to 7 degrees. Very handy for rule of thumb, but it's all interferometry. You guys probably have some questions on all this. KC2WTB, I take it. K2RIW in the TechNet, listening.
KC2WGB, Dick, I believe maybe next week you can go into the diffraction limited comparison with the telescopes, which are something that's not well understood, and it does have a good effect. But, you know, we've got almost an hour on this, which I think is sufficient. There's a lot to digest there, and they're going to have to hear it a couple of times, maybe in different directions, but great explanation. Interesting subject.
Hey, let's take one or two questions right now. I think somebody I did hear who's probably got a question. Give me a call. That is a name right now.
One at Horn antenna, one source. So, as long as you operate with electromagnetic spectrum, whether it's laser, whether we deal with the any kind of wavelength, we're dealing with electromagnetic waves. To say the motion of the antenna, of the motion of the device, and memorizing the time frame at which the measurement was taken. I don't need 2, 3, 4 corners, whatever you want. You can have a spatial three-dimensional interferometry. You could, of course, in the certain wavelengths, have collimation or autocollimation. Depends. I tell you.
Question WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I'm trying to understand the basic theory of what the computer is compensating for. You've got the moment arm, and that's turning. When it turns, it's looking at a light source. So that means one side is receiving this signal early, and let's say the right side is receiving it late, because now it's turned. So what the computer is compensating for that distance, say it's 5 feet off or 20 feet off, no matter what it is, that computer's got to compensate that distance, because the photons that are coming from that light are going to hit one earlier than the other one. The computer has to compensate for that and make it as if both photons hit that same piece, hit the parabolic reflected at the exact same time. Is that right?
Hey, you made a very logical conclusion from the words I gave you, Paul. And the words I gave you were a little bit too simple. I'll give you the next step of this. First of all, I told you that as you rotate the moment arm of this interferometer, yes, one antenna is moving forward, one antenna is moving back, one is advancing in phase, one is retarding in phase, as far as the signal received at the remote site is concerned. And as you rotate that antenna continuously and take data measurements of signal strength, you're now going to be drawing this interferometry antenna pattern. It's a whole bunch of what looks like almost equal sine waves, but they get weaker and weaker as they get further and further out, so to speak. If you gather all of that data and put that into a spreadsheet, use the right kind of a computer modeling program, which is a little bit similar to, it could be called holography, it could be called digital data processing, it could be called inverse Fourier transform. There's some fancy computer programs that'll take that great big data set, and in other words, the actual thing you're looking at with your radio telescope may be a point source star. But that point source on your interferometer, let me drop it. That simple point source, as you rotate your interferometer, is going to give you a whole bunch of interferometry lobes that slowly change in amplitude as you get further and further away from boresight. You put all of that data set, all of that data that you just measured, into the right kind of computer program, which knows the nature of your antenna. It now can boil it all down to one simple dot in the center of the screen, which is that star with very high resolution. Correspondingly, if that so-called star really was a nebula, which has got a whole lot of gas clouds and that are red, green, and blue all around it, so to speak, again, that data set that I just described to you, put that data set into the right kind of a computer program, it can crank it all back out and now get an unambiguous picture. So, I made it sound too simple as to what the computer processing does to convert the interferometry program into a high-resolution picture. There's a lot